ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
What comes next in the Middle East? America and its allies are being drawn further into the quagmire there. They see Iran as the central actor with its vast network of proxies across the region.
So as the threats multiply to lives, to global trade, military and political decision makers, including our own, are scrambling to prevent all-out war.
But with Iran playing such a decisive role, how can we respond when we know so little about what's going on inside the country?
It's clear Iran is playing a dangerous game. But what are the missing pieces of this puzzle?
It's Geraldine Doogue here.
And it's Hamish McDonald.
This is Global.
Sorry.
This is Global Roaming.
Now, welcome back to Global Roaming Part 2. We're delighted to have you company. We got some fantastic feedback. Very robust, Hamish, didn't we?
Some of it. Also very thoughtful, and we will get to some of that during this week's episode. We were going to take you to Indonesia this week because there's a huge election about to unfold there. Very important to us here in Australia, but global events are unfolding quickly. So next week is Indonesia. This week instead, Jerry?
This week we've had a drone strike killing three American troops in Jordan, and that was the first time US soldiers were killed by enemy fire in the Middle East since October the 7th. And an Iranian-backed militia group has claimed responsibility. So, I mean, it clearly changes the playing field, certainly theoretically. And, you know, John Bolton, whom we spoke to last week, is now really, dare I say, joined by a chorus of American voices calling for a direct strike on Iran.
Yeah, Faraz Samara wrote to us from Port Macquarie saying, why give such a war-hungry, ultra-right-wing, staunch pro-Israel American politician a podium in your first episode? She does go on to say, thankfully, the discussion between you afterwards helped cool my hot nerves. But I think it's pretty obvious that actually right now he's not alone.
Yeah, and that's why I felt and sort of argued very strongly that we needed to go inside Iran for this episode. We know so little about it. We talk about it constantly, but we actually don't ask about the people of Iran, about the power plays inside Iran. And I just felt very strongly that before we jump into this next stage of the conversation, we had to understand that quite a lot more, because it's such a fascinating country. You know, when you think about it, the people who've sort of feasted on films like 300 and, you know, Russell Crowe lookalikes playing, taking on Xerxes, the great Persian army, that is the precursor of modern Iran.
So I want to ask you about something though, Jerry, because 1970s, pre-revolution, you actually went to Iran.
And it's affected me, I think, massively. I went to see a friend in the 70s, before the revolution, and saw the sophistication of the place. And I just suddenly thought, in years later, I thought, is that the place I saw?
So I've read about it in books. I've watched documentaries from the Shah's time. I've seen photographic essays of it, you know, women in miniskirts, none of the black headscarves.
Super stylish.
What was it like that?
Oh, very much so. Cars everywhere, traffic like you wouldn't believe. It was a much smaller population too then, but very sophisticated and, you know, fabulous food and very much a sense of themselves as inheritors of that Persian legendary tradition and highly educated. I have to confess, I was much younger then, I couldn't feel the turmoil that must have been lurking very close to the surface, because then in comes Ayatollah Khomeini from France and there's a revolution, an Islamic revolution that is still underway, and that's what we're talking about now.
So we're going to be joined on this episode by Ali Ansari, who's a gifted, respected academic scholar of Iranian descent, who is really one of the most, I think, insightful voices around on the question.
I'd put him even higher. I think he's really a sort of a luminary, actually. I think he's got a very good understanding. He conveys it well. He does see the complexity of it.
So before we get to that, let's just lay the landscape of what happened in Iran to kind of get us to this point, Geraldine. The revolution happens in 1979, an Islamic revolution. They depose the Shah, and then in comes the Ayatollah. He's then subsequently replaced by the current Ayatollah Khamenei, similar name. So obviously that gets a bit confusing. There's also, so he's the supreme leader. There's a president. The current president is Raisi. He's another hardliner. But of course, the power of the presidency is questionable. Then there's also the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and obviously all of these external expeditionary forces, if you want to call them that, that have operated so effectively in Iraq, in Syria in recent years. That makes this a very interesting picture. And then on top of that, there's also these internal struggles because of large protest movements.
Yeah, like the one that arose over Mahsa Amini, that young woman who took off her headscarf and looks like she was killed as a result of it. And that prompted this enormous uproar across Iran, particularly among the young, particularly among women, incredibly brave. And everybody said, oh, this is it. This is it. This is going to be the tipping point. But it has not turned out to be, because they've clamped down in their usual way, which probably makes them all the more concerned and anxious, as you say, frightened of their own people.
I want to understand that, but I also want to understand Iran's relationship with the outside world, places like China, like Russia. We've had a lot of questions about that. And so I think that probably sets up our interview with Ali Ansari. Would you like to introduce him?
I would love to introduce Ali Ansari. He's Professor of Iranian History and Founding Director of the Institute for Iranian Studies at the University of St Andrews in Scotland.
Ali Ansari, welcome to Global Roaming.
Very good to be with you.
Look, what we've been trying to wrestle with, Ali, is what is Iran's game here? Like, because we know so little about the country in terms of what comes out, what's allowed to come out of it, what's it trying to do in all of this?
Well, I mean, this is it's an interesting question because, I mean, people are a bit baffled as to what the, you know, the overall aims are. Iran has a sort of a public face which will tell you one thing, you know, that they don't want conflict, that they want to minimize tensions. But then on the other hand, they seem to be supporting all sorts of militia units and non-state actors in the region. And, you know, to add to this, they will suddenly somewhat sort of abruptly launch a missile attack into Pakistani Balochistan. So, it, you know, one of the things that I think we have to, I suppose, do to help with our assessment, and it is a sort of an assessment of what we think is going on, is to maybe have a better understanding of what's going on inside the country itself. You know, what are the decision-making processes inside the country? What are the domestic drivers for their actions? And I think what you see when you sort of lift the lid a bit and have a look inside is a country that is a much more nervous, much more jittery, is sort of still living with the aftershocks of the major uprising last year, has an economy that is extremely weak and quite vulnerable. And, you know, what this behavior indicates is that it's got a certain, I don't know, posture that it wants to retain overseas, you know, this sort of idea that it's sort of leading the axis of resistance. So it has this really sort of robust rhetoric, while at the same time, you know, feeling a little bit sort of limited because it knows its domestic situation is fairly weak.
I'm so interested that you say that, Ali, because I think on one level we see what Iran is saying about all of this, but there is a piece of this puzzle that I think for many of us is missing, which is about what's going on inside. And I spent a bit of time today looking at some of the Iranian newspapers, trying to use Google Translate to help me get around what's actually on the front pages. And it's not all of this conflict. A lot of it is very sort of bog standard domestic stuff about scientific development and achievements and the Ayatollah visiting factories. Can you take us to the Iranian dinner tables? What are the conversations they're having that correspond with the conversations we're all having about what we see?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I mean, one of the conversations they're having, obviously, is the war in Gaza. I mean, that's one thing. But the other thing they're having is the sort of upcoming parliamentary elections and other elections that are coming up in March, April. And I mean, these, you know, these are about to fall flat. I mean, this is the problem. The regime has a real, real problem. They did, even their own internal polling has suggested that no more than 10% of the citizens of Tehran will come out and vote. And in the countryside, it's not much better, actually. And, you know, the direction of travel is going south as well in this respect. So it's not that they're generating excitement about this. I mean, they're sort of banning everyone anyway. I mean, ex-president Rouhani has been told he can't stand because he no longer fits the criteria of a reliable candidate. I mean, the whole thing is very, very messy, very, very unsatisfactory on many different levels. And then, you know, the economy, people are very worried about the economy. There's the run on the real has begun again. So, you know, you can have all this bombast abroad and this possible confrontation with the United States looming. But what does it do? It creates panic in the streets of Tehran. I mean, basically in Iran, people aren't interested. I mean, they're much more preoccupied with their own problems. And, you know, the Palestinian cause is viewed with a degree of ambivalence at the moment, which would have been unheard of 10 years ago in Iran. I mean, this is the shocking reality of what's going on, that you get mass demonstrations in Western capitals. But in Iran, I think the largest crowd they were able to pull out and support the Palestinians was 3,000.
So who is in charge then? If this is underway, I mean, that's an amazing list that you've just described there. Who is calling the shots then? Is it the Ayatollah himself? Is it the president? Is it the Revolutionary Guard or some new group or what?
Well, it's certainly not the president. I mean, we'll put the president aside. I mean, the president is sort of like a technocratic and, you know, an individual. He's actually not very good at his job anyway. So ostensibly, the person where the buck stops is the supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei. But here's the twist that we have is Ayatollah Khamenei is clearly very ill. There is a succession looming. People know. I mean, this is the difference. People know now there's a succession looming. We don't know exactly when, obviously, he's going to pass on. But the fact is that people are now preparing for that. I mean, they have a fairly good idea who the successor is going to be. From what we can see in the press and discussions, it's going to be one of his sons. It's not rocket science on that level. But at the same time, any transition of this nature creates a degree of nervousness. And I think that's what we're seeing. So there are people in charge, but they're not, haven't got the sort of firm hand on the tiller that they might have had in previous years.
But there are other power struggles, though, within Iran, aren't there, between the hardliners and the reformers. And Raisi, the current president, is part of that picture, even if, as you're saying, he's kind of irrelevant right now politically. I'm so fascinated by the idea that this Islamic revolution that was all about deposing a Shah, a hereditary monarchy, is now in a position where this current Ayatollah
King
might replace himself or want himself Absolutely. To be succeeded by his own son. Would Iranians
cop
that?
This is the perversity of the situation we find ourselves in. I mean, and you sort of summed up the problem, you know, in a nutshell, really, that here you have a revolution that had certain goals and ambitions, and it's clearly turned those on its head. Certainly for the majority of Iranians who, you know, what they thought they were getting was an Islamic republic. What they're really getting is a sort of an Islamic autocracy of some sort, an Islamic monarchy, if you will. I mean, on your point about the competition between different factions, there is none really anymore. I mean, in the reformers as a political force don't exist anymore. They've been completely obliterated from the political scene. So the sort of reform, quote, moderate wing that might have been more prominent, say, 20 years ago. I mean, what I say to people are they're either in prison, exile, or dead. I mean, this is basically the situation. So what you have at the moment is a sort of a very, very, tight competition between hardliners and even more hardliners. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the basis of what's going on. And this is why, you know, less than 10% of the population of Tehran are going to vote.
Well, so
nothing to vote for.
Does that mean they're sort of sullen? I mean, just two things that strike me from you saying that. Have you got a sullen population who is sitting back there sort of feeling furious but not able to do anything? And I just wonder about the army. Like, how is the military affected by this set of views or things being so set in stone? Like, are they, quote, safe for the Republic?
Well, it's a very interesting question because last year, of course, during the uprisings, so the Revolutionary Guards are basically seen as the military wing of the revolution, and they're meant to be sort of very tight and, you know, in control of the situation. Even last year, however, you know, one of the things that came out of the protests was that many of the children of these very Revolutionary Guards were the people out on the streets. So there were divisions already, you know, we could say social divisions within the Revolutionary Guard. Now, the army, with the sort of the regular army, is certainly not the sort of institution it was sort of pre-revolution because it's been sort of purged and infiltrated and so on and so forth. Nonetheless, it has retained a very distinctive identity vis-a-vis the Revolutionary Guard. And again, one of the chants that used to come out last year was, you know, where is the army? When is the army going to support the people? When is the, you know? So there is a question mark there again, and I think you're quite right to sort of highlight this, that you have this sort of very discontented, annoyed, irritated, you know, sullen is a good word, actually, you know, population that really doesn't want to play ball anymore. And actually, it's looking for salvation. It's a very dangerous moment.
Dangerous,
really,
indeed.
You know, I mean, this is a moment where you get a population that wants change, doesn't know how it's going to get it, but is looking for it. And it just reinforces the sense of paranoia that they have. I mean, they're deeply worried. They're looking over their shoulders, wondering who might be coming up. And of course, that's a very, you know, paranoia is a sort of it's like a self-defeating cycle, if I can put it that way. The more scared you are, the more oppressive you become. The more oppressive you become, the more, you know, scared you become. It doesn't end well.
So, Alec, can you draw a line between this febrile domestic picture that you're painting for us and the bigger picture that we're now seeing and Iran's hatred of Israel and the West? Is that ideological? Is it religious? Is it political? How do you connect all of these dots for us?
I mean, it's all three, really. I mean, in that sense, I mean, it is deeply ideological. They've got an ideology that they've been promoting for, you know, 40 years, certainly hardliners. And here they have a sort of an opportunity to step up to the plate. And what's interesting, really, is they haven't really stepped up to the plate in the way that their proxies have expected them to. Mm. So the Houthis and Hamas have both complained and said, you know, where the hell are you? You know, I mean, what's going on? So what you have is a situation where they clearly have their proxies that have been enabled, facilitated, you know, armed by Iran. But at the same time, the Iranians are also finding that perhaps, A, they don't want to give a very clear green light to certain activities, but B, and this is also quite problematic for them, they are actually probably losing control over some of their proxies. I mean, they don't have quite the grip that they might have thought they had.
That is exactly what I wanted to ask you about. We keep hearing that this is all orchestrated by the timing, the funding, the weaponry. It's all from Iran. Do you think that's a bit overblown?
Let me sort of say that I don't think it's overblown when you understand the modus operandi of Iran. And the modus operandi of Iran is one in which plausible deniability rules. Okay, so you have a hierarchy, an autocracy, a hierarchy that's, as I was saying earlier, you know, very paranoid. And nobody wants to take responsibility. So what you get is you never get clear orders. It's quite true, I think, that the Iranians would not have said to Hamas or to Houthis or whatever, do this then at this time, whatever. What they will have said is something must be done. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, this is the way that they operate. I mean, it's like I said to people, I said, why would you give anti-ship missiles to the Houthis if you weren't expecting them to use them against ships? I mean, what you know what I mean? I mean, what was the point of that? You know, so it doesn't make sense to me to say, oh, well, you know, we gave them all this kit, but we didn't want them, you know. Well, I mean, so you've got to be, you know, the Iranians will always claim, as they're doing now, oh, it's nothing to do with us, Gov. But no, I mean, there's a limit to that. You know, if you're fighting for national liberation in Yemen, fine. You know, there's a cause there. We can have a debate about it. But if you're starting to supply them with anti-ship missiles, you're obviously expecting them to do something else. And that has nothing to do with the domestic fight in Yemen.
Yeah.
You know, so this is the point.
Look, can I just slightly shift the conversation to Iran's relationship with Russia and also with China? Because we had quite a few people writing into us after our first podcast last week saying we want to better understand what's going on there, because it's a bit complicated, isn't it?
Well, the Chinese relationship is a much more pragmatic one, certainly from the Chinese perspective. The Chinese have a particular role that they want to play internationally. They're quite cautious. You know, at the moment, they're sort of standing back a bit, to be honest, and think it's quite good fun to see the West getting into, you know, into various difficulties. But their relationship with Iran is, I mean, one would say it's good on one level, but it's not productive. I mean, there's not a huge amount going on. The Russian relationship is much more intimate and much tighter, and actually relates to a sort of a military-industrial relationship between the Revolutionary Guard Corps and the various sort of military mafias that run Russia. And, you know, up until really the invasion of Ukraine, even I sort of had this view that, you know, I thought the relationship with Russia was much tighter than many people thought. But even I didn't think it was quite going to be quite as tight as it became. I mean, I didn't think the Iranians would go hook, line and sinker right in with, you know, the Russians and back them on the invasion of Ukraine at the expense of basically resuscitating the nuclear agreement.
I think it's a disastrous decision by the Iranians, don't you?
Yeah, yeah. I think from a historical perspective, and I've had a couple of people query me about this, because I made a comment on another interview I did where I said that I thought it was probably the most serious strategic blunder the Iranians had made in a long time. And, you know, people queried it on the basis of, well, it seemed like a very wise decision. I said, oh, yes, it's a very good short-term decision. But for me, I think the long-term ramifications of this will be very, very serious for them. They basically, as someone said, effectively sold their independence to Russia for a degree of short-term security. But what sort of security is it tying yourself to Putin's Russia?
On the topic of possible strategic blunders, John Bolton was with us last week.
Right.
He said that Iran has paid no price yet for its actions and that it needs to. And just a week later, there's now a chorus of voices saying much the same, particularly in America. That would obviously suggest a direct strike on Iran itself. Where would that lead us? Where could that lead us?
So there is a central question for Western policymakers at the moment, and that is, how do you reestablish the balance of deterrence with Iran? And people are trying to find ways of, you know, it's quite true. I mean, the central question that Bolton has raised is right, that, you know, the Iranians have been able to carry out certain actions with very little blowback for them. I mean, this is the thing. So for the Iranians, it's like, well, it's a free shot. You know, we can do what we want. So there has to be an element of there has to be some sort of response. Now, what is this response? It's unclear to me that a response is necessarily simply, you know, fighting fire with fire, if you would put it. There is an element of that, true, you know, but I think there are other ways also to hurt them. And one of them is through the economy, of course. The Americans have, you know, fairly serious sanctions on Iran, but they're not actually observing them. So Iran is still able to sell quite a bit of oil around the world. If the Americans tightened up that oil sanction, that could be a serious squeeze on Iran. There are other things you can do, not going straight to Iran. I mean, there are Iranian assets in the region, in the Persian Gulf. There's a sort of a spy boat, from what I understand, sitting around in the Gulf of Aden or whatever. I mean, there are actions that could be taken against those assets, which I think would also send a signal. So my point is that, you know, there are means and things that one can do, but one must be very clever and intelligent about how you're applying force.
Ali, before we let you go, Geraldine painted this incredible picture of Iran in the 1970s pre-revolution for us earlier in this episode. Does that still exist in any way today?
It exists in the mind. That's where it exists.
Oh, dear.
You know, there are two facets to this. There's a popular view on the streets that has deep nostalgia for the 1970s. Okay, so that there are those who are very nostalgic about the monarchy, but then you have regime hardliners who have bought in to some of the Shah's bombast, but without the Shah's capability. I mean, this is the difference. Yeah, and you know what we have in Iran today is, as I would say to people, you know, the Islamic Republic has all the Shah's ambitions, fewer of the abilities, none of the virtues and all the vices.
Oh, that's a devastating end. Okay, we know what you think. Look, thank you very much indeed for giving us your time. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Ali Ansari, what a blockbuster end to that conversation, Geraldine. Sure, what surprised you most about what he had to say?
I think it was that sense that the population is so disenchanted. That's what I got from it. But they don't know what, they can't do anything about it. So they're sitting there, you know, which must be the case for a lot of people in Russia as well, that they're sitting there sort of impotent. Now, that is dangerous for a regime. I don't care who they are. If you look at sort of throughout history, that's powder keg territory. It's just that whenever they do try to set up some sort of powder keg blow, the authorities come down with the most appalling repression on them, which I no doubt that could happen again. So it was just the fact that he believes 10% will come out for those elections. Now, that surprised me.
And actually, to that very point, we both read the same comments from Sanam Vakil from Chatham House, who said that the great irony is that few Iranians support Tehran's regional strategy. A common chant of Iranian protests, and this is sort of talking about the last 18 months, has been, not Gaza, not Lebanon. I give my life for Iran.
Yes, it's incredible that. And, you know, But they would give their life for Iran, which is the message I think that also the Americans ought to take note. Any thought of hitting the homeland, I think, would be, you know, the equivalent of us trying to invade Turkey sort of thing and having, you know, you suddenly find an Ataturk arises, you know, as we did in Gallipoli, and everything changes. I suppose I also felt what he was remarking about the army was very interesting. Now, I've heard no discussion about that and about, in effect, the army sort of sitting there knowing that the citizens are saying, hey, what are you doing? Is this really how you want to defend the Republic? I thought that was very interesting. And the whole business about Russia. Now, you know, I like to think I keep up to date with quite a lot of this, but I did not fully grasp that inextricably close links between Russia and Iran. And, you know, some of our reading, as you know, we did, where we found that Putin had gone there to visit Khamenei, the Ayatollah, and actually, according to Ali in another interview, said, you know, I feel like I've looked into the face of Jesus Christ, with all these sort of funny millenarian overtones harking back to Russian Orthodoxy. So that was all quite fresh for me too.
A really big takeout for me from that interview was Ali's comments about Iran's strategic blunder and Russia, but also those sort of clear internal weaknesses today. And I reckon those of you that felt your blood boiling as you listened to John Bolton talking about Iran will not have missed the fact that Ali, in some ways, shared part of his view, which is that Iran really has not been made to feel a penalty for its actions in the region, and that the United States needs to think carefully about doing just that. He obviously has a different view about direct strikes, but clearly some similarities. And I guess even just in the week since we spoke to John Bolton, I think there's been a lot of change in terms of the view internationally about penalty for Iran.
Now, we've come to that point in the proceedings where we make our suggestions about what we've seen or heard or whatever. And I think, given that we're talking about Iran, people might like to be reminded about some of the brilliant Iranian films. And if you want to get a real sense of that complexity of the population that we were describing and the sophistication that's there, I remind people about a wonderful film. I think it's one of the best films I've ever seen, actually, called A Separation, which was, it came out, oh, a good 10 years ago, but I think it's still available, and that's a superb film. And also that Reading Lolita in Iran, the Azanafisi book, I just think it just reminds you this place is not a cardboard cutout, which I do think there's a bit of a feeling of that, you know, starts to arise in these highly emotive times.
Two recommendations, Jerry.
I know. Look, I've broken the rules, Hamish, creating.
I'm going to share a piece by Thomas Friedman. You read it as well. It was actually sent to me by a dear friend and colleague here at the ABC. Connects a lot of the dots between Israel, Gaza, the war in Ukraine, Russia, the broader geopolitics in the way that only those really great writers can do. It'll take you a couple of minutes. Well worth a read. We'll put it in the show notes, perhaps as well, maybe with a photo of you in Iran in 1974, Jerry.
I don't think I can pull one out, but I tell you, it's affected me deeply, as I said earlier, and I won't forget that time.
Keep the feedback coming, global.roaming@abc.net.au. We love hearing from you. We're really looking forward to more of this robust but respectful, curious debate and discussion.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.